Ace Podcast.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And today we have yet another spooky tale. This one dials the spook factor up to 11, I would say.
Meh. The spook factor or the drug factor?
Well, that's fair. This one is I'm not gonna do a disclaimer before the show like we've done before, because apparently people think those are silly and unnecessary. For me, there are certain topics that your kids probably shouldn't listen to, and there are other ones that are fine. Hi Brazil, that's fine. King Tut, that's fine. The majority of what we do is completely fine for kids.
Yes.
And even some kids are totally fine with everything we do. This is one of those ones where if your kid gets freaked out, if your kid is already scared of aliens, or you're worried your kid's going to be scared of aliens, or if you are worried and scared about aliens, it's not just about kids, you might want to skip over this one. It does contain...
graphic.
Yeah. Graphic, frightening images.
Yeah.
So, that's just your word of warning. If you think you can handle it, you probably can. If you think you can't handle it, you probably can't. That's fine. And we're going to love you nonetheless, and we're going to have something absolutely spook-free for you next week. So,
I don't even know what he's talking about.
Hey! So, Jason.
Sam.
What are we talking about this week?
We're talking about the Mojave Incident.
The Mojave Incident.
Yeah, that one.
Now, the Mojave Incident is one of those gems of UFO culture that has kind of been... lost to the wayside. It's not Whitley Strieber's or Roswell.
I can see it, you know, of course, getting pushed to the side over those. But I definitely feel like it still has absolutely made an impact.
Oh, totally.
At least pop culture-wise. I mean, when I think of aliens in the desert, this is pretty much exactly what comes to mind.
This is, yeah. I was really surprised because the story that we're going to focus on, it took place in 1989... or it started in 1989, there was the book that was originally written about it called Searchers, and then that came out in 1995, and then about 20 years later, in 2015, they re-released it under the name Mojave Incident. And it's one that, for the right circles of UFO lore, you probably know about it, you've probably heard about it, but I believe that the majority of our listeners are never going to have heard about it before.
I can't wait. My excitement is overbearing.
It's bubbling. I can tell you're glowing right now with joy and excitement. Or maybe that's radiation.
Could be both. Why don't you bring us into the Mojave Incident here? Who are we actually talking about today?
So today we're going to be talking about Steve and Don Hess. Now, in the book Mojave Incident and the book Searchers, they're referred to under the pseudonyms Tom and Elise Gifford. However, they recently came out and made their name public.
How recent was that?
It was after the republishing of Mojave Incident in 2015. So it would have been in the last 2 years. They came out publicly as, hey, this is us. So because they decided to do that, I felt comfortable using their names instead of the pseudonyms. The event, of course, takes place in the Mojave Desert, which we're not going to go too much into here. Essentially, it's a huge desert. It makes up parts of California, Nevada, Utah, and Arizona. It's the driest desert in North America, and it occupies 47,877 square miles. Everything that took place in this account took place in the California region of the desert. Its name means beside the water in the language of the native Mojave tribe. Like I said, we're focusing on Steve and Don Hess. Now, they are described as fairly normal people. They live in the area of Upland, California. The book opens with them preparing for a weekend camping getaway. Now, the Hesses have two children at home, Stephen Jr. and Bethany. By all accounts, it was going to be a great weekend away. Steve was hopeful that he was going to bag a big deer. He and his father, the man that they call Wolfie, he and Wolfie were out hunting in the Mojave just last week, and they'd actually been hunting out there for 15 years. He had seen a buck, but it had gotten away. And Dawn was hoping really just for a weekend away. You know, she's a young mother, mother of two at this point, and they just wanted to have some time together. So they decide, okay, we're going to go ahead. We've got this camper trailer that's attached to the pickup truck. They load up. Steve's parents, Wolfie and Carol, stay with the kids, and they head out. By all accounts, it was looking good. They started with a detour to a popular casino called Whiskey Pete's.
I mean, if that doesn't get you going, I don't know what will.
I know. It's the perfect way to start a weekend. And they won like $100 in cash or something. They were pretty jazzed about that. But the thing is, it kept them at the casino because they were winning. They stayed much longer than they planned. So they had hoped to be at their campground by, you know, nightfall or shortly after. They didn't even leave the casino until 2 a.m. So they're driving along for a little bit, but suddenly the weather changed from, you know, nice clear evening to just this dense thick fog. And this,
which fast weather change happens incredibly quick in deserts.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's pretty normal stuff.
That's normal. So the thick fog compared with just sheets of rain made the conditions unsafe. So they decide they're going to pull off of the road and just camp by the side of the road for the night. The next morning, they wake up, they drive to the Mid-Hills campground, which was full, even though they had really never seen it be full before, but they just had to find another place to camp. And these events coalesce into them arriving at their final destination, which is a camp site that they make in the depth of a basin between the Tabletop and Woods Mountains, deep in the Mojave with absolutely no other human civilization or contact or presence in sight, which is exactly what Steve wanted. He was totally fine with that. It kind of freaked Dawn out a little bit. She mentions how she was worried that somebody was going to come through the campground and like murder them. And she was just a paranoid
person.
That's
a decent fear.
It is. Yeah. You know, it's the middle of the desert. No one around, anything like that. He says, you know what? It's going to be fine. Don't worry too much about it. Now, that evening was October 21st of 1989. I was able to take a look. The sun set that evening at 5:58 p.m. About an hour and a half later after that is when things really start to get weird. Steve and Dawn had simply been sitting. They'd been roasting food, making steaks. They talk about taking bread and throwing it and watching the kangaroo rats come and eat it. And it was just a nice, idyllic time. However, at around 7:30, Steve realizes how dark it is, and he gets around to lighting this Coleman lantern that they had brought with them. As he's doing that, he feels a little weird. He says, I know that there's no one around. I know it's just me and Dawn, but I can't help but feel like I'm being watched. And he turns around actually to make a joke to Dawn about it. You know, look at us, we're in the middle of freaking nowhere. There's no one around, and yet I still feel like I'm being watched. When his eyes just are naturally, he talks about them just being drawn up, like as if he almost wasn't intending to, but he ends up looking above Tabletop Mountain, which is a mesa, so it's just a completely flat mountain that they were camping between. And above Tabletop Mountain, they see this big shining light just hovering above it. He knew it wasn't a star. It was too big to be a star. It was too bright to be a star. And he was a pretty efficient stargazer because he had been an outdoorsman all his life. And he just froze. Just takes a double take, double check, sees it. It's still there. But suddenly the light seems to sink. It goes down behind the mountain as if it was hiding from him. He didn't feel like it was pertinent to tell Dawn what he had seen, and his first rational thought was that there had been a craft from a nearby Air Force base, which is something to definitely mention. Located near their campsite, relatively near their campsite, there are multiple different military installations. There's Nellis Air Force Base, 29 Palms, which is a Marine Combat Training Center, Fort Irwin, which is a general military training center, and the Naval Air Weapon Station at China Lake.
Okay, so we have four?
At least four, yeah.
Wow.
And they're all meant for, I mean, you have...
Mainly training.
Yeah, mainly training, maneuvers, naval weapons. They're, none of them seem like particularly quiet, sleepy bases. I don't know if there's such a thing as a sleepy, quiet military base. There's probably not, but...
Well, I mean, Gowan's not that bad.
No, Gowan's really not that bad. But these would be the kinds of places where you'd have, theoretically, experimental craft or military maneuvers, and that's exactly what he's thinking it is and hoping it is. He sits down next to Dawn, and he just puts it out of his mind. They go back to stargazing. He's pointing out the constellations to her, and he mentions something about a double star. It looks like one point of light because it's so bright, but if you zoomed in, it's actually two different stars.
Mm-hmm.
And she looks to her right and makes a little quip and says, like, oh, if that's a double star over there, that must be a triple star. And Steve's like, what are you talking about, woman? And he looks over to his right, and there, hovering above Tabletop Mountain, he sees 9 points of light that they both described them as so bright it was like they were throwing off daylight, illuminating the entire area. And Dawn very quickly realizes those aren't any stars. Steve is just freaking out. He just internally panicking, mm-hmm. panicking. But he still says, oh, you know, they're probably just, and this cracks me up, they're weather balloons.
Ah, the great scapegoat. The great weather balloons.
The great ancestral enemy of there the ufologist. The weather balloon.
Aliens up in them skies. No, sir, it's weather balloons.
It's a weather balloon.
The downed weather balloon.
Gas.
That's all that was?
Nothing.
Great.
Those bodies? Weather balloons. Smaller weather balloons.
We had a cluster of weather balloons go down last week. You should have seen it.
29 killed. It was a tragedy.
Oh, man. Weather balloons. Anyway, so.
So, and I just.
Gosh.
That just makes me laugh.
Why? Do we really use weather balloons that much?
I really, truly don't know.
In the 80s, maybe?
Maybe we did. I feel like now
any
with
of our
satellites,
older listeners, if yeah. you'd like to let us know.
Yeah.
On how often weather balloons were used or even were visible or went down.
Yeah, like did
that
they,
would be lovely.
My biggest question is, did they emit light? Why would this balloon emit
all
light?
I can think is like reflection.
Oh, I guess that's fair.
That's the only thing I can think of, because anything that's traveling upward in the air is going to reflect light off the bottom of it. So
that's fair.
I mean, if you just release a regular balloon that's like shiny, it'll do that. So that's my guess. It's just reflection. Intensity wise, that's interesting how they spoke that it was just like similar to daylight.
Yeah.
I wonder if they meant just purely off of the intensity of it or actually like the color as well. Because artificially it's super hard to mimic daylight.
Yeah.
So it'd be really weird if it was kind of doing both. It's like they just had 9 suns in front of them.
Right. I think that it was just the intensity, not like the hue.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's how it's described, as just as bright. It doesn't mention the color being abnormal or different from the stars at all, which I think it would have.
That's fair. But 9 orbs.
9 dots of light.
I'm going to call them orbs.
Do it. Call them orbs.
They're orbs of light.
That's literally what they are.
Yep. Continue on, Sam.
Steve says, these are weather balloons, Dawn. And Dawn says, I don't know about that. And she says, they look like
they're militarized weather balloons, Sam. Right? That's what they are.
She says, they look like they're made of Mylar, and he just goes with it. He's like, yeah, Mylar, of course. Weather balloons are made of Mylar. I'm pretty sure they're not. Yeah, that makes sense. These are definitely just weather balloons. But he can't get Dawn to necessarily believe him. Her next thought after it's weather balloons is actually, and we've got to remember this is 1989, she's worried it's the Russians. She's worried that they are under surveillance by the Russian government or the Russian military.
Which I find to be a little bit of a stretch that these two individuals were under surveillance instead of one of those 4 military bases.
Right. Well, but you've got to think it would be the most likely the area that was under surveillance.
Of course. But, I mean, what's the point of going out into the middle of nowhere when really you've got 4 points that you want to be essentially bouncing between if there's just...
Yeah.
I'm saying.
I agree with you. 100% there. At precisely 9:13 p.m., these lights, which were just bright, but just sitting there, they start to blink. And this one would blink over here, and then this one would blink over here.
Was it blinking red and green?
No, it was just darn. Like, why?
Those colors are used blinking back and forth for hypnosis.
Ooh. Interesting. No, no. They were just going off and going on. And they also start to move towards the couple. They end up positioned above Steve and Dawn. And Steve and Dawn are now, both of them are freaking out. Steve drops the "it's a weather balloon" act. Suddenly, the objects over them disappear. And they get a little freaked out. They look around. And in the blink of an eye, they seem to reappear 400 meters away. A few thousand feet up in the air in the formation of a giant M shape. So Dawn at this point is inconsolable, and it takes Steve a few minutes as well to just calm down, start breathing again. As soon as he gets level-headed, he begins to talk to her and say, "It's okay. Who knows what it is, but I'm sure we're going to be fine." And suddenly, everything gets a lot brighter. And they look up above them.
This is still the nighttime, right?
This is still the nighttime. This is probably, I would say, around 9:30 at this point.
Dude, this is a crazy meteor shower.
At about 9:30, they look up above them, and instead of there being 9 points of light, there are hundreds of them. Every part of the night sky is lit up by a great glowing orb. They are completely and totally fear-struck. They can't even move. And as they sit there in terror, they see the light start to drift down. It's very slow, as if they're parachuting, but this spurs them into action. Dawn is now 100% convinced that this is a Russian invasion. Steve isn't saying much other than to direct her, saying, "Get in the camper, get in the camper." He grabs his gun. They both jump into
the camper. Get in the car and go.
That's true as well. Well, and she says something along those lines of, "Why don't we just go?" And Steve says, "Well, we can't. We're trapped," essentially, because the lights are also coming down on the other side of them. They're surrounded by the lights. And he just says, We just gotta hole up. We're gonna be fine." He grabs a shotgun. They get in the camper. He positions himself with the gun pointed out the window, just getting ready to come at whatever comes at him. The lights finally hit the earth, and as they do, they change from a very slow, graceful ascent to just lightning speed, rocketing across the desert towards their camper. All of them are converging on the point where Steve and Dawn are. Steve starts screaming, saying, "I'm going to shoot you. Like, come at me. I will shoot you. You will be dead. I'm going to take you out." But Dawn starts screaming, "Can't you hear them? Can't you hear them? Stop that. Can't you hear them?" And at first he had no idea what she was saying, but after a few moments, a deep, cold voice started in his head, basically saying if they attempted to harm them, that Steve and Dawn would be killed, absolutely. Right after this occurs, again, they're looking out the window of the camper, and they see two beings kind of appear. It doesn't describe exactly what they were like. He just states that they were about 3 feet tall, 2 feet wide, and they were this bluish gray color that seemed to be like they were in flux. So they were like growing a little bit, shrinking a little bit out and in. And he described them being what he thought holograms would look like. At this point, they realize two important things. The first is that there's no more light in the sky. Not just are there no more points of light falling, the moon is gone, the stars are gone, but all of the dots have fallen to Earth and are making their way to the camper. The other thing is that aside from the holograms that had appeared, or what he assumed to be holograms, there was nothing. The world was completely quiet. Like I said earlier, they were throwing bits of bread to the kangaroo rats and watching them bounce around. They were listening to the animals in the night, and everything is just completely and dead silent. Then they feel their energy being drained. They feel like they can't resist, they can't shout, they can't fight, and it was all they could do to keep breathing, and suddenly even their breathing stopped because they were looking out into the darkness. All of the light streaming towards them had disappeared and been replaced by thousands of pairs of glowing red eyes.
Man, that's just a bad trip.
It is a bad image to see. regardless of any mental state that you may be in or why you're there, that is not what you want to see in the middle of the desert at night. The eyes begin to get closer and closer to the camper, and as they approach, suddenly they see the forms that accompany them. These beings that they see are no more than 3 feet tall. They have heads described as the size of cats. The heads seem to be regularly shaped from what I can hear. They're not like elongated skulls or anything like that, but their limbs were very long and very thin, and they were almost translucent. The eyes were, like we said, red, glowing, malevolent.
You mean like an owl's?
Like, yes, like 1,000 owls.
Hey, dude, just saying.
It's possible.
The eye shine on owls is red.
Anything can happen in the desert.
No, not everything.
Anything can happen in the desert. Now, the strange thing here as well, these beings approached the camper, and as soon as they were inside of it, they started to, basically, it was described as frolicking. Like, they were just happy about something. They're overrunning, they're messing with all of the equipment, they're climbing trees, they're climbing on top of the camper, and basically playing around. It was described as childlike, like if a child was really happy that they were about to kill you. That was the feeling that they got from these beings, which they start referring to as gremlins.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Easy connection.
Yep. At this point, Don is 100% certain that they're going to get killed by these gremlins, and they start to exchange descriptions. They're completing each other's sentences instead of saying, you know, Don, I see red eyes. Do you see red eyes? Don says, Steve, what do you see? And then they complete the sentence. The one other interesting thing about these gremlins is that they're not, like, they're playing on trees and stuff, but the trees aren't responding. The branches aren't bending even a little bit. Nothing seems to be reacting here. And it's as if they're weightless in their own way. The other thing about them, if we think back to, like, Whitley Strieber's Communion, in Communion, you encounter the Greys, right? The Greys are described as robotic, insect-like.
Yeah.
They're a hive mind that works in step.
I think the big difference as well is just the type of eyes that they have, too.
Yeah, that's true. These don't
have black eyes or just empty holes,
mm-hmm,
versus these malevolent red shiny eyes.
Glowing red eyes. And these creatures are obviously full of free will and individualism.
A lot more agile.
Yeah, they're doing... Well.
They're moving around, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're playful, like you said.
Yeah.
Which is weird. Completely not like the description that we got in Communion.
The exact opposite. Steve attempts to leave the camper, but for every step that he takes out of it, the monitors, as they've started to refer to them, take a step towards him. Finally, he gets close enough to touch one of them, and when he does, he feels this powerful electric shock that actually knocks him back.
Why would you want to touch one?
Just to see. You're telling me. You're telling me.
All right.
You're not going to touch it. Heck, I would probably lick it if I know myself.
To be completely real.
If we're just going to be honest here.
There was a mess of some sort in my pants. That's what will happen. I mean, to be completely fair, a lot of what we've been talking about reminds me a lot of, like, me coming out of, after surgery, coming out of, gosh, I can't.
Like anesthesia?
Yeah, and, exactly. Yeah. Like, seeing all these weird things happen and the distortion of what I'm actually viewing. They're very familiar to me, even though, no, it wasn't necessarily lights, but
right.
I saw windows form out of the wall.
That's crazy.
And like, it undulated as they were separating and becoming three windows instead of just one. I mean, there's a lot of things that affect your perception.
Yeah.
That, and I mean, the constant kind of suggestion to one another that they keep making,
mm-hmm,
really kind of guides, I feel like, each other.
Right.
I'm not saying that they decided to go out to the desert and have too much fun.
Right.
But, I mean, I don't know what was in their stakes.
Right. Yeah, it's entirely possible. Even beyond something like a planned hallucinogenic experience or something like that, I mean, it's not super feasible in this case, I would say, but you do have, like, ergot poisoning, things like that, naturally occurring mold and spores.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of different things that can occur, and I think just being out in the desert as well gives you
a different psyche.
Exactly. Yeah, I think, I mean, the desert's always been kind of associated with a sort of spirituality as well.
Right.
And I think that's mainly because of how small you feel
in the vast open,
surrounded about that. Yeah, and I mean, there's just so many more stars when you're that far away from civilization. Anyway, those are some of my thoughts.
Yeah, good stuff.
Let's continue down this trip.
Good. Down the rabbit hole, Alice. All right.
You know it.
So Steve attempts to leave the camper. For every step he takes, the monitoring beings took a step towards him. He finally gets close enough, and he tries to touch one of them, and he feels a powerful electric shock that knocks him back. As he's retreating into the camper, he sees, they both see, descending out of a thick cloud in the sky, the mothership.
Of course.
The ship was gobsmackingly huge. It was circular, a disc that had an elevated dome in the middle of it, and it measured, like, its diameter, they estimated to be longer than an American football field, which for any international listeners means it was about 100 yards. The ship was encircled with brilliant, bright, flashing lights, much like what they had seen in the sky turn into these gremlins, and on the underbelly of it, there were six smaller craft identical to the mothership other than their size, which were described as being the size of helicopters. Suddenly, a beam of light about 200 feet in diameter shoots down from the center of the spacecraft. It begins vacuuming up everything that it came in contact with. Trees, cacti, even plants and animals were pulled into the craft. And another craft, a large triangle, descended from the mothership and began to scour the desert floor. The triangle was inverted, so the tip of it was touching the floor while the opposing side of it was in the air. Now, after observing this happen, Dawn does something that she does quite a bit in this, and it mentions earlier in the book that she was raised with an LDS upbringing, and her faith had drastically affected her life and her worldview and all of that. So in this case, when she is quite certain they're about to be killed, confronting the supernatural, the unexplainable, Dawn begins to pray and just praying that they won't be killed, but especially that their children will not be harmed, and that their children, if they are killed, that their children will be taken care of and not have to worry and think, oh, where did mommy and daddy go? Not have to grow up with any of that, but they'll be taken care of and they're happy and they're healthy. Now, as she prays, another being appears, and this is where we get into the gray archetype. It's not the gray itself, I would say, though. There are nine of these beings circling the camper and staring in through the windows. They're taller than the other. They're about 5 feet tall. Their eyes were huge and completely black. Their limbs were long and spindly, and their torsos were described as the size of a 3-year-old child. I thought that was a little bit of a weird description until I remembered that their son was 3 years old at that point. So it makes sense that that's like how they would
describe it.
Describe it there.
But otherwise, it's weird. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very weird way strange. To describe
a torso.
There, she doesn't mention the head shape particularly. I don't believe it is the elongated skull, but it is a larger skull than what looks normal on
like
a human
on that
being.
Body.
Yeah.
That body size.
Yeah.
Like a child then.
Yeah, in its own way. A 5 foot tall child. Think of a 5 foot tall 3-year old. Whoa.
I just feel really small now.
Me too. Yeah, me too, man. Yeah.
The children of tomorrow.
The children of tomorrow. Now this immediately, like I said, based on her description, she's thinking of her children. She's praying for her children. She sees this, describes it in terms familiar with her children. And this brings up another weird thing in the story. And that is that Dawn, it mentions this at the beginning of the book, but we kept it for now. Dawn feels like she has a psychic connection to one of their children, specifically Steven Jr. Even though he was just a toddler, she felt that they were able to communicate with each other on a deeper level just by looking into each other's eyes.
Aw, that's a great little motherly bond.
It is. It totally is. But
I mean, I kind of get that too. Like, My little brother was very, very young. I worked as like a translator a lot of the times. I actually understood what he was talking about most of the time.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I kind of get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not even though like toddlers don't really form full thoughts and sentences.
Right.
In the proper.
Norm.
Neither do
well,
I.
Not the proper, but the normal, way. And it
unless
was...
they're British babies, then of course they're proper.
Of course they are. So proper.
Williamson's probably like...
He's extremely
top-notch.
Proper. Yes. Yeah. Yes, governor.
Indubitably.
Hello to our British listeners. We love you
I
all.
I am so sorry.
So...
It's all right. I'm just a stupid American.
That's all right. We all are. So...
No, not all of us.
They would... look into each other's eyes, and suddenly if Don wanted Steven Jr. to do something, he would do it. If Steven Jr. wanted Don to do something, she knew what that was and she would do it. And it was a parental bond for sure, but she felt like there was something more to it, more than what she had with her other child at the time, who was Bethany.
Oh, poor Beth.
Yeah. Well, not like she was a favorite or anything. They were just better connected. Now, at this moment, when these beings first appear, that psychic connection kicks in, and Dawn claims that she felt and heard Steven Jr. screaming out to her in his dreams, that he was in pain and being hurt by some malevolent force. She communicates this to her husband, Steven, and he starts to get super angry. He's about at the point where he's going to reach out, and again, right as he does, he feels his energy just drain and sap away like it did the first time. But then something new happens. He gets hit mentally by some force. He describes it as like being whacked in the head, and he was afraid that he had had a stroke. Now, suddenly, memories started flooding back to him, and at first they seem positive. He's visualizing and seeing these things as if he's actually there, which is another callback kind of to Whitley Strieber's Communion. When the being, the other, the visitor, touched him with the quote-unquote magic wand and conjured these images, it's the same sort of feeling, but it's a different result here. He remembers things like playing college football, fishing with his father as a child, him and Dawn falling in love, getting married.
So very positive memories, not negative.
Not negative, terrible.
Forecast, yeah.
Yeah, which is exactly what happened to Whitley Strieber. However, after a few moments of these positive memories, instead, they start to conjure emotions. He starts to feel instead of remember, and he feels pride and jealousy and humiliation, joy. He feels every possible emotion, and it to me, I think of it like speeding up and speeding up and speeding up and speeding up, and then suddenly it all stops, and he essentially gets dropped back into this extremely long, complex memory. Of him, he's around 12 years old, the sun has gone down hours ago, and he's with a friend. His father, Wolfie, and his father's friend took their sons out camping, and late at night, the boys decided, well, we're going to go fishing out on our own because we're, you know, 12 years old, and we can fish by ourselves, and we don't need our dads. And so they're at this lake, and they're casting their lines, they're reeling in the fish, and actually, as his friend reels in this huge, huge fish... Suddenly, over a mountain about 500 yards away, he sees a great big glowing light. Even from that distance, it appeared to be the size of a basketball. And just like an hour or two ago in real time, when or in, you know, not memory time, when the beings reached the campground and everything went quiet, the exact same thing happened then. The crickets stopped chirping. The animals stopped making noise, the wind stopped, and they just start to book it. His friend and him trip over each other. His friend gets up and leaves, just leaves him in the dirt, and Steve is laying on his back, looking up at this craft, which is now above them, and it shoots a blinding ray of white light down onto his body. As soon as that happens, the memory ends, and he's back in the trailer with Dawn. He had had knowledge of this event previously, and that's another thing that has been crossing his mind. This wasn't just like some, you know, manufactured image, but he remembered specifically it was 14 years earlier. This all happened exactly the way he remembered, and he had never told anybody, not even Dawn. And the place where it had happened was Lake Mojave, the mountains that he saw the light rising over were the Woods Mountains, which along with the Tabletop Mountain created this basin. So it was in pretty much exactly the same area, or at least bordered by the same mountain range. Steve was certain, without a doubt, that the beings that harassed him then were the ones harassing them now. Now, the same process happens to Dawn right after Steve comes back to reality. Very similarly, she feels the ups and downs of her life, but having seen Steve go through all of this, it's simply, she doesn't enjoy any of it. Like, Steve seems to enjoy kind of at first, oh, this is so fun, like, I'm in a positive, happy place. The entire time, all Dawn can think about is her children and how they're hurt, they're hurting right now, and it takes her and colors her experience, and then just like Steve, where it ramps up, it ramps up, it ramps up, and then it drops, the same thing happens to her, and she gets dropped back in time to the point where she is giving birth to Steven Jr. They're in the hospital room. It goes through all these scientific medical terms. Essentially, the baby is delivered totally fine at first. However, after a moment, the doctor says, we got to get him into the neonatal unit. There's an issue with his heart. And Dawn passes out. She wakes up hours later to find a nurse in her room, and she asks to see her child. She's told the doctor's going to be there shortly to talk to her, but she starts hearing a child crying from down the hallway, and she tries to get out of bed. The doctor comes in, tells her the baby was born with a heart defect, but everything's going to be A-okay. There's nothing to worry about. But this crying just intensifies, and she just has to get up and check it out. So she jumps out of bed. The doctor and nurse try to restrain her at first, but they're like, you know what, screw it. Let's just let her go. It'll be fine. And on the way to the neonatal unit, she hears whisperings from the staff of the hospital.
Wait. The staff just let her out?
Yeah.
She just woke up from having her child and passing out. They're like, yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah.
We won't help her.
No, they just let her go. They don't, like, support her at all. They just let her do this.
What kind of hospital is she at?
Well, you're going to hear what kind of hospital she's in. So she's walking down the corridor, and she hears whisperings, and people, no one's addressing her, but they're saying things like, it's so sad, what a tragedy, what a terrible, awful thing. And at the end of a long corridor, she sees Steve. He doesn't even register that she's there at first, and he's talking to himself. He says, they tried, they did everything they could, but they were outnumbered. There were five of them, five with gizmos like they'd never imagined. He looks then at her, looks her straight in the eyes, and just says, I'm sorry. She's drawn forward because the crying of the child just intensifies, and the next person she meets down the hallway is Wolfie, Steve's father, who tells her they did everything they could. Then Steve's mother, Carol, looks at her and says, they'll adjust. Kids always do. She comes to a set of doors with the words operating room painted on them in big red letters.
Wow, this is a sweet dream sequence.
Yeah, man. This is like cinematic.
Yeah.
Is what it is. Now, this is the point where if you are listening with kids or if you are inclined to be spooked, this and one other part were the only parts that really chilled me. So, I don't know. Whatever. Live your life.
Go ahead and set that freezer down to 5.
Yes.
So the coldest, right?
She...
Chill me, bro.
Chill me. She comes to a set of doors with the words operating room painted on them in big red letters, and she hears the baby continuing to cry, and she knows it's coming from this area. She bursts inside, and she sees four doctors surrounding a table over which there is a large, blindingly bright circular light. On the table is Steve Jr., but he's at his current age of 3 years old. He's not a baby. He's crying, and he's screaming. He sits up and stares his mother in the eyes, and she sees his chest split open, and his heart is bound up with all sorts of different clamps and tubes going in and out of it. He stares at her and says, why did you leave me, Mommy? You left me alone, and now they've taken me with them. Suddenly, she realizes that these doctors aren't doctors at all. It's the beings outside of the camper. Thank you. He says, Mommy, Mommy, they've taken me and used me for experiments. And at that point, her mind just tears apart. and suddenly she finds herself back in the camper with Steve. Now, at this point, both Steve and Dawn felt themselves just coming apart. They were having troubles breathing, they were shaking, and they were even to the point where they were afraid they were going to pass out or even just go into shock and die. However, the next thing that happens is that a vapor rolls in to the camper.
Ah, Vicks Vapor Rub. Helps me breathe. Back to you,
that
Sam.
That wasn't terrible. I will keep that in. This podcast in no way is advertised or endorsed by Vicks Vapor Rubs.
Or Pepsi.
Views are those... How do people say? The views expressed are those of the host and not of the Vicks Vapor Rub Company. Thank you for that ad spot, Jason.
You're welcome, Sam.
We're not getting paid by Vicks Vapor Rub for this, but if you work for Vicks, let us know. Anyway, so How did we do? So this vapor rolls in to the camper, and it essentially seems to reset their bodies. They're no longer hyperventilating. They're no longer shaking or anything like that. And they feel as though they are deliberately being kept alive and kept conscious. For a while after this, they sit in silence, and then they start discussing their experience. At this point, Dawn gets more into the metaphysical of, like, why are they doing this? Why are we here? And she states that it's the reactions that these beings want. She says that they aren't capable of feeling human emotions or anything even like human emotions, and they're putting them through this.
That's odd, because the way that she described them earlier and they're playing their emotions in general.
Right. The gremlins.
Felt very humanistic.
Totally. I believe what she's referencing here are what are known as, they actually call them the illuminated beings, which we didn't really mention. These beings are glowing with a whitish sort of light around them. And I think she's mentioning that specifically about the illuminated beings, not the gremlin type beings.
Oh, okay.
Because these visions started when the illuminated ones
right,
show
the five
up.
Foot tall ones.
Yes, the 5 foot gotcha. Tall, circle Falling. Of nine. So she mentions as well that she feels like this might have something to do with their souls. Like I said, she had a very religious upbringing, but she feels like this place, this indentation in the Mojave Desert, was something like a way station for the souls of the dying and the souls of those being born. She said that she had read somewhere that the mystics believed that there were places where the spiritual and physical planes of reality exist, and if this were true, she postulates, this would make these creatures more than just aliens, but into angels or demons, basically psychopomps, ferrying people into the afterlife. Now, Steve believes things very differently. He believes that they were there to mine the minerals in the material-rich ground of the Mojave.
Bad boy, Steve.
Yeah, he's more on the science side of things for sure here. He states that they must have come to this place before, you know, 14 earlier years earlier and stumbled upon him, and now they're back to complete their mission, and you know what? Here's this dude again. Like, we checked him out 14 years ago. Let's check him out now. Let's see how he's grown, see what kind of mate he chose, that sort of thing. This is all just kind of a bonus
it's like,
to
it's
their...
like when you release a bird into the wild.
Right. That's exactly what he thinks that it's like, except worse, like a lot worse. Not
right.
just not like a nice thing, like a bad thing.
Fair.
He thinks it's just another bonus perk of theirs on the mining trip. Hey, let's psychologically torture these humans to see what they'll do. Haha. So Dawn has one last thing to say about it, though. She had found a book in their local library the previous summer called Mystic Places. And in it, she had found mentioned that this general area of the Mojave was sacred to the First People tribes. She said it was a place where the tribal lore indicated that this is where the shamans and chiefs of the tribe met with their deities. Now, she says that there are petroglyphs in the region. What she actually means is there are geoglyphs in the region. Do you know what a geoglyph is?
Big ol' earth drawing.
It's a big ol' earth drawing. A lot of our listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with the Nazca lines of Peru.
Bingo. Pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And essentially, it is a just massive marking on the ground that cannot be seen in totality except from the air. the Mojave has two of these specifically that she has in mind here, and they're called the Mojave Twins. What they look like are two slightly deformed humanoid beings that are said to represent good and evil. And she claims that these twins look just like the illuminated figures outside. Now, after this, there is a account given. Essentially, they go through the same process of reliving memories and things like that. In this case, what it brings up, and we're just going to gloss right past this because we're not going to get into the specifics because we don't want to. But essentially, what happens is Dawn relives an experience earlier in her life when she, as a child, was sexually assaulted. The only reason we mention this is because it helps to illuminate Dawn's mental state as well as the things that happen after the encounter. In my opinion here, I don't know if it's caused by the extraterrestrials. I don't know if it's an amalgamation of both. But essentially what she goes through is a PTSD flashback where she's not just remembering this account. She's reliving it and all of its horror and its terror. After she makes it through that, she comes out hoping to be comforted and loved by Steve. But Steve is behaving in a way that mirrors that of her childhood attacker. Thankfully, nothing happens in that realm, and she snaps him out of it. And Steve claims that it wasn't him doing these things, but that someone else was controlling him. Now, Steve didn't have any great big trauma from his past. However, he as well goes into a hallucinogenic state. He finds himself in the middle of the forest. From the flora, he judges, okay, we're probably in Washington, we might be in Oregon, but I'm definitely in the forest. And he finds himself extremely hungry and follows his nose to a nearby campfire. Once there, he finds a rabbit roasting over a fire pit. He approaches the pit and realizes that there are no other tracks on the ground. There's no human footprints, there's no signs of activity, but his mind is just saying, what does it matter? Just eat that. You're hungry. You need to eat that. And he feels more like an animal. He takes the rabbit. He eats it. He's full. He's fat. He's happy. And he feels his humanity returning. And that's when he realizes just how wrong everything here is. And he is reminded of one terrifying thought, which is that bears are baited with meat. After they're baited, they're tracked. And after they're tracked, they're shot. And pretty much the moment the word shot goes through his head, he feels a bullet rip through his left leg. He falls to the ground and then gets up. He ignores everything that's happening to him, and he asks in his mind, why am I here? And he gets a response from deep in his head, and it says, you are here to be hunted. He starts running and finds himself quickly up a tree. He hears sounds of hunters and dogs approaching the tree, and suddenly the dogs are given a sniff of a piece of clothing of his that was torn off in his running away. They alert on the tree, and from there the hunter shoots him out of it. He pulls him up by the hair, and he looks at the other hunters. The hunter looks at the other hunters and says, well, he's a good size, ain't he? And then he proceeds to skin Steve, all while he is entirely conscious and alive and physically feeling this pain. Right as he would, in theory, die, he's also brought back. Now, after this, they just sit there. They're basically just talking about their feelings about everything. And they do so until about 3 a.m. And that's when the beings appear to leave. The gremlins all just start scurrying away from the camper. And Steve starts cheering. He feels like he's almost high on the joy of the thought of outlasting them. And Dawn says a quick prayer of thanks. Suddenly, however, the world goes quiet again. These illuminated beings step forward again to the camper windows. And the gremlins swarm the camper with more intensity than before, really actually trying to overrun it or get inside, it seems. It's just another part of the psychological torture that's being inflicted on them. Tom threatens them again, grabs his gun, gets ready to shoot, and again telepathically he's told that they will be killed if they harm any of these beings. while all of this is happening, we have in the background that inverted triangle, which they call the Searcher. And the Searcher and the Probe of Light have been scouring the desert, and now they seem focused and moving towards the camper itself. There's this drilling noise, this deep, low drilling that has accompanied the Searcher, and it's getting to the point where it's so close that it's causing the entire truck to shake and to rattle. And they know that they're about to be abducted. Dawn suggests that they should just kill themselves. She says, I know it's a sin, but I know that God will understand. And Steven says, no, we're going to fight. We're not doing that. Steve. Yeah, he is resilient to the last. And then the truck starts to be lifted off of the ground. At this point, the gremlins and the illuminated ones are no longer moving. The gremlins are no longer overrunning things. They're just sitting there staring at them. And the gremlins especially seem to be very, very happy about what's happening here. Now, right before they're sucked up into the craft, one of the illuminated beings raises a finger, and from it, a fleck of light about the size of a cigarette butt passes through out of its finger, through the window, and into Dawn's abdomen. And with that, they are sucked up into space. But it wasn't just them and their vehicle. The entire chunk of Earth that they had been camping on seemed to be taken with them. The only difference in the environment once it was all over was that there was no mothership above them. The gremlins then truly did leave, and the illuminated beings disappeared as well. The only alien object that remained was the large triangle, the Searcher, but the drilling noise had stopped. Suddenly, a being of blinding beauty appeared, descending from the sky. They said that in any other context, any other time, she would have been an angel. She tells them, it's almost over. They're going to have peace soon. Everything's going to be okay. And it's very reminiscent of Whitley Strieber's account again of this advocate, this feminine alien being who seems to take care of the humans and try to calm them down and keep them happy. Shortly after this, they fall asleep. But they're not clear if they ever have gone back down. You know, they're essentially what has happened and what they talk about is being in a museum.
Yeah, I feel like their high probably ended during their sleep.
It could be. It could be. Now they wake up the next morning and it's a bright, beautiful day. They're back down in the basin, or at least they appear to be. They see the sun above them. Everything seems completely normal. And this really surprises me. The very first thing that Dawn does is decides to check the radio. She says, she thinks, they both think...
It's still the Russians?
Well, they both think that there is absolutely no way that no one else saw what happened to them. And honestly, they're kind of worried that they are in the middle of World War III. That it was, you know, if it was the Russians have invaded, but more likely that the entire Earth is under siege from this extraterrestrial force. And so she turns on the radio, scanning the news channels, and of course there's nothing. There's no mention at all of lights in the sky, alien beings, anything like that.
Because nothing really happened.
Well, it just surprises me that she would, I mean, on the outside, looking in at abduction experiences, of course there's nothing on the radio. Like, nobody ever sees the people getting abducted. Nobody ever sees the UFOs. They have some sort of way, in my humble opinion, of cloaking themselves. I personally think...
Except they like really bright lights.
Right. I personally think, like, if we're gonna talk about it really quick here...
Yeah, dude, totally.
Because, you know, the gremlins are jumping all over the trees and nothing's bending, nothing's reacting. And you have this Oz effect where there's no sound, there's no wind, there's no movement. I personally think that they may have some sort of ability to manipulate time in a way that the entire abduction happens in less than a second. And so all that would be seen is maybe a bright flash of light. But in the time period of that bright flash of light, 6 hours passes for the people being abducted. That's just me. That's my crazy theory of the day.
But see, okay, so yeah. The problem with that is that they are still perceiving it as real time anyway.
Right.
So they would have to be sped up to a certain speed themselves. Because I talked about this time travel. You'd have to be physically moving a whole lot quicker to be perceiving the passage of time going the same speed, even though when it's going a lot faster.
But I'm not saying, and I'm more than happy to concede, that there's no physical reality we know of yet that would allow this to happen. I'm saying that essentially time stops for the people being abducted. And that in those seconds, they perceive time, you know, because he looks at his watch and he says, oh, it's 3 a.m. Well, that's because his watch continues.
Right. It's relative. It's with relative. Him.
Yeah.
Right.
So in that second that it takes for them to be abducted and the everything to happen, in that second, they live 6, 10, whatever hours. But to everyone else, nothing happens because the time stops. Everything comes in. They do their whole thing and then they go
out. But the perception of time, when they wake back up, it's still it's morning. It's what the time should be.
Right, right. Which, I mean, at a certain point, with the barrier of sleep in between them, I feel like, personally, that would be the best way to end that experience because you're not able to judge time as you're asleep. I see what you're saying. Like, if you were conscious for all of it, you'd be sitting there, and then suddenly everything would happen really quick, and it'd be really freaky, and then everything would, like, stabilize. But if you're asleep when that happens, you're not going to know any, you know, be any wiser, I would say.
I mean, that's fair, but we also have an internal clock as well that triggers us to sleep, to wake back up most of the time.
I dig.
So, I mean, we can go back and forth on this forever.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my crazy theory of the day.
Okay.
I wanted to put that out now instead of in the Patreon extension.
Beautiful.
All right. Wonderful. So, of course, nothing happens. Of course, nothing. No one sees. There's nothing on the radio. They actually go ahead and find the closest humans they can, which is an elderly couple who's camping, not in the area, but out past the mountains, back on the way back into town, essentially. And they say, hey, did you see anything weird last night in the sky? And he was like, nope. To be fair, what he said is, I didn't see anything if it happened after 7:30, because that's when me and my wife go to sleep, because we're adorable old people.
That's fair.
I love it. To me, even if they were asleep, they would have been waken up by the drilling and the lights and all of that.
That's the other thing you go to the desert for, retirement.
That's true.
It's retirement, drugs, and Burning Man.
There we go. And I mean, really, what is Burning Man but retiring to drugs?
It's pretty much, right? Yeah, it's both of those things combined into one epic horror.
So they say, okay, well, this guy didn't see anything. So they say, okay, but wait, what about the kids? You know, the kids are in pain. You know, Steven Jr. was screaming out to Don. And so they decide, okay, we're going to find a payphone and we're going to call, check on the kids, and then we're just going to go home. But as they are driving these back roads in the mountains, suddenly in their rearview mirror over Tabletop Mountain, they see this inverted triangular craft, the Searcher, and it appears to be following them. And they pass like quite a few payphones and they're like, I don't care. Like, I care, but I'm not gonna get killed over a phone call. And they go and they go and go until they finally hit the freeway. And when they hit the freeway, that's when it seems to back off and then eventually disappear. Now, they finally call home at a gas station. The kids are fine. They had a great weekend. Nothing weird happened. However, right as they're kind of feeling like, okay, maybe we were wrong. Maybe it was a dream. Maybe it was, who knows what it was. Right as this is happening.
Reason.
Right as reason takes hold, Dawn touches her neck, and there she feels two identical puncture marks on her neck. And she just looks at Steve and says, this isn't over yet. Now they get home. They dismissed Steve's parents. They hang out with the kids. Everything seems fine, but their life just changes. They go from being like, Steve was Mr. Dependable at work, and suddenly he can't focus. He says he goes to work and he thinks, why does any of it matter? Like, why does work matter? I think he's like an architect. Why do buildings matter? Like, there is a greater, higher force out there waiting to invade us. Why does any of this matter? And I can personally attest to having that happen to me quite often when I go to work and I'm like,
nothing.
The aliens
really
are coming, man. They're almost here. If they're not here already, why am I at work right now? And that's exactly what he was feeling. Dawn turns into a bit of a UFO nut. She's reading all these books and all this lore, And disturbingly, they also have impressions of the beings watching them in their home or watching their children.
Do, 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 do.
Exactly. About a week later on the 27th, they say, you know what? We've got to go back. We got to find evidence. We got to tell ourselves we're not crazy. And so they leave a note, which is really, it's like basically saying, like, if we don't come back, we love you very much. And it's be a very strange thing for a child to find. But they head out, they go back to the exact same area, and they find nothing. But once they enter the basin, they do begin, both of them, to start having flashbacks. They don't stay for long. They had gone to find evidence, but once they were there, they realized they weren't going to find anything. If this thing came in, searched the desert, combed the desert, there's a mothership above us, and you know the old guy and his wife didn't hear or see anything, they're not going to find any physical evidence. So they decide, okay, we're going to head home. But even then, as they're leaving the valley, as they enter it and leave it, they still feel like they're being watched.
Yeah, dude, this infrasound.
Thank you. This just continues. Several months later in February, they finally decide we can't do this alone. They confide in Dawn's parents first. They told them exactly what happened, and Dawn's parents basically said, like, we believe you. We believe that you believe what you're telling me
right,
here.
Just like how I believe that they believe that they
right.
saw what they saw.
But there has to be another explanation. It's probably just military. It's probably just, you know, something weird like that. They're very upset by this. They don't feel heard. They don't feel, you know, accepted. They go home, and they both have similar dreams. I believe Steve is playing football, and Dawn is in church, but in both of these dreams, the people watching them have these big black eyes, and suddenly they're awoken by a screaming coming from the children's room. They run in to find Stephen Jr. standing, completely asleep, screaming and spinning like a top. It looked like something was spinning him. He wasn't just turning around or anything like that. Now they woke him up, and he seemed totally fine. He said, what's wrong? What's going on? And they're like, oh crap, nothing. Everything's fine. Don't worry about it. They turn off the light and he starts screaming, and they say, what's wrong? And he says, when you turn off the lights, that's when the monsters come. The little, short, ugly monsters with the glowing red eyes. And that scares them. And it scares me. Now they say nothing else until May, when Steve was on the brink of losing his job, and neither of them felt safe in their own home. They were having visions. They were having nightmares. They would wake up in the night and they would see shadows seeming to retreat from the bed as if they were catching someone in the act of watching them. They would have weird, cold winds blow through the house. And that was another one of their signs that there's something going on here, that the visitors are here. And finally, they confide all of this to Steve's parents, Wolfie and Carol. And they responded very similar to Dawn's parents, but with one variation. Wolfie finally mentions the possibility of it being a psyop or a psychological operation. Essentially, what he posits is that, of course, like had already been thought and explained to them, multiple military installations in the area. They may have been doused with some kind of experimental chemical, seen some kind of experimental craft, but that doesn't necessarily explain the aftermath of the visions of creatures and beings in their home, of feeling watched and hunted. And they feel like the military may be using them as some sort of a test subject for this psychological warfare campaign. They were like, they weren't super jazzed about this, but they admitted, you know, maybe you're right. Like, maybe that makes the most sense out of everything we'd heard, but they still weren't convinced. Now, 4 weeks later, this is the other thing that just scares the crap out of me. 4 weeks later, they're sleeping in bed. Steve is dreaming that he's back in the counter or back in the camper, surrounded by these creatures. And then suddenly he's dreaming that he's back in bed. He sees in his mind's eye one of the illuminated figures with no mouth, no lips, just a slit in its face and big black eyes walking through the home. And it walks through the wall behind their bed where the headboard sits. And it puts its hand down and it starts rubbing. It has three fingers and it rubs its fingers all over Don's face. And he opens his eyes and looks up at it, and he's told, "You're dreaming." He looks at Dawn, and suddenly he sees burn marks on her face in the shape of three long fingers. And then he realizes that he isn't dreaming at all, and they both start screaming. They take pictures of these burn marks that have appeared in real life. This is not a dream. They take pictures of these burn marks, and he just remembers trying to comfort her and comfort her and comfort her, and then it's black. And the next thing he remembers is waking up to her crying, looking at herself in the mirror. And essentially, all of this happened in the morning, and they forgot all of it. And so she woke up again later and saw these burn marks on her face and saw these pictures they had taken, and she put two and two together, and that was it for them. They could not continue living the way she was living. The Polaroids over time became blackened. They eventually went dark, so no photographic evidence.
Done.
However,
that's what I was looking for right now.
I know. However, Vivian, who was Dawn's mother, came and stayed with her. Dawn didn't leave the house until the burns disappeared about 24 hours later. They were just suddenly gone. And Vivian testifies, basically, that this did happen, that this is true. She saw the burns. Now, the last significant alien contact occurs around December 18th, 1990, when they wake up in the night and they are surrounded by tall, dark, shadowy beings. At this point, they had already started the process of going to therapy or setting up the therapy, talking to trained professionals about this, but they hadn't got to it just yet. Now, this night, they wake up and there are tall, dark figures around the bed. And essentially, again, in kind of a hypnotic state, they conceive a child. And as soon as they do, Dawn says, essentially, "I don't want to be pregnant." And Steve looks her in the eyes and says, "I don't want you to be pregnant either, but you are," as soon as that happens. Now, under the advice of Ron Felger, the author of this book, the couple actually goes to Washington, D.C., to the National Center for Trauma. There, on June 10th, they meet with the director of that center, one Dr. Bernard Vitone, or Vitone. He had interviewed them each separately, a process which took 5 hours, and when they came back together, he said he was extremely happy to tell them that there was absolutely no sign of mental illness in their accounts or in their behaviors. Now, this is something that I did a little bit of research on. I didn't find anything that directly, like, contradicted what was said, but I'm going to say straight up that, A, Dr. Bernard Vitone is a real person. Right now, he's not the head of the trauma center, but he's head of, I think, like, depression, the Center for Depression Anxiety Disorders.
Okay.
So he's a completely real person
mm-hmm.
who is totally fine with this book. Like, he has not come out and said, like, "That's not true," or anything like that. Essentially, what he says is that they could not have been, their experiences do not make sense to be either mental illness or to be induced by drugs or, like, brain tumors, neurological problems. And he has a few different reasons for that. The first is that typically auditory and visual hallucinations do not share a common source. You have either an auditory hallucination or a visual one. You may have some visual discrepancies, like seeing things like multiply or, you know, expand or contract, stuff like that, littler stuff. But for a full-blown vision of alien beings, a mothership above, what's causing that isn't going to cause the auditory hallucinations of the voices talking to them, the interaction with the searching drill, and all of that. For that reason, he says that while he will not say it's aliens that did it, he says that they were responding to a real event of some sort. They ask, like, well, could it have been the military? Could they have gassed us or anything like that? And he says, it's theoretically possible, but here's the thing. You're not going to have a shared hallucination. It simply doesn't happen. Now, he tried his best to make sure that they weren't playing off of each other. You know, did you see red eyes? Oh, yeah, I saw red eyes, and things like that, by doing these separate interviews. However, and again, in the book, it does make it very clear that they were not doing that sort of thing. They were not volunteering information to each other. However, I personally will concede it's entirely possible that they were, and that, you know, they're sitting there saying, oh, do you see these red eyes? And then,
boom,
oh, yeah, man, I do see those red
yeah,
eyes.
Yeah, and that's more where I'm leaning.
Totally.
Power suggestion.
Totally.
I mean, sure, I don't know enough about hallucinations.
Right.
Being both audio and visual occurring at the same time from the same source. But mass hallucinations absolutely do happen as well. So having a shared hallucination isn't far-fetched in my mind.
I think it's...
Especially if they are, again, playing off each other.
Right. If they're
even
playing
if they're
off
not even,
other.
Like, really realizing it. I mean, for that, what they have gone through, that experience, there's a lot else going on to where you might not remember saying some particular detail to the other person.
Right.
Like, it's completely possible that's happening.
If you're
too.
That terrified, who can give an accurate account of what happened, for sure? But I don't know. I enjoy what he's saying here, not because of the, you know, no mass hallucinations. I think he's talking more about the specific.
They're very close to each other. It's not, you know, far-fetched to think that they couldn't share details or have a very similar experience.
Right, 100%. To me, the important thing about this is that this guy, who I'm going to trust what he knows, which is the neurological, psychological part of it, where he says these hallucinations couldn't have come from one source. It couldn't be that you ate something weird. It couldn't be that you got gassed, because they simply are two different types of hallucinations. And that's why he says, he even comes up and says, like, I don't necessarily think you were abducted by aliens. I think that you were responding to some real life traumatic event that maybe your mind has warped in some way. But he says that they're not just crazy. They're not just taking drugs or anything like that. Now, this obviously validates them up the yin-yang. They are super jacked to hear that.
Right. It's what they want to hear.
It's exactly what they were hoping to hear. And I mean, you got to think, it's been like a year and a half at this point, I think. And they're just thinking, am I crazy? Am I not crazy? Like, even things that I have seen that I know are real, not even paranormal things, just amazing things I've seen, I've been like, did that actually happen? Am I making that up? Especially as time goes on. And so to them, it's like saying, okay, you're not crazy. That's the place to start. Now, the final step in their saga, just like with the majority of alien abduction scenarios, it is the hypnotic regressions. They both independently underwent hypnosis that was administrated by a Dr. Annixter. They're both interviewed by him. And for both of them, independently, they remember before they actually fell asleep in the truck, in the ship, they were taken from the truck, and they had maneuvers, medical experiments done on them. Dawn explained how there was a tracking device that had been implemented in her. That's what those two circular puncture wounds were. And Steve gives a description of probing and being looked over and all of that. Under hypnosis, it's Dawn who explains the purpose of what happened. And like I, you know, we touched on it earlier, Dawn seems to be the more metaphysical of the two. Steve is like, they're here to mine. And Dawn is like, they're here to communicate. And so she's the one who gives the explanation. She says that the purpose for these extraterrestrial visits is that there are four close galactic neighbors to us, and they are starting in the Milky Way on Earth with the Hesses to change the Milky Way into a more unified, harmonious place. And when that is done, they will be able to join this galactic federation. Dawn explains that this will happen within their children's lifetime and says that these beings are sent by the One Supreme, who dictates the movements of all things and wishes for all people to have unity and peace. They ask her more about the One Supreme, and she just shoots back automatically, you know, read the Bible to learn more about him. She claims that TVs and movies, things like ALF, E.T., Close Encounters of the Third Kind, even Star Trek, were psychological tools that were being used to ready us for this alien contact. And at the end of the hypnosis session, Dr. Anixter, again, real person, and he, as opposed to Dr. Vatone, who simply hasn't said anything against the book, Dr. Anixter has come out and in full support of the book, saying, like, yes, this did happen. He tells them that it is his personal and professional opinion that they have had a close encounter of the third kind, unlike any he had ever seen or heard of before in his professional experience. Now, after this experience, they would still feel watched at times. They felt, you know, observed, but they no longer had fear. They no longer felt dread. Over all of it, what they remembered most was that final encounter with the angelic being, who they referred to as the Comforter. This Comforter dominated and controlled the others, protecting them by the will of the Supreme Being, and essentially it made them think, you know what? It's all going to be okay. What do you think, Jason?
Well,
why don't you tell me what you're thinking, what your theories are? I think we've already covered a good amount.
Dude, infrasound, bro.
So explain what that crazy means really quick.
So infrasound, essentially, the human ear can hear sounds from 20 gigahertz to, what is it,
18 hertz?
No. Anything under 20 hertz, we cannot hear. So infrasounds are sounds that are below that. Our eyes will actually resonate at 18 hertz, which is kind of crazy. That can cause hallucinations, which is nuts. But other levels of infrasound can also cause anxiety. It can also cause us to think that we are being watched as well. So I think that a lot of it has to do with that kind of thing. Because infrasound doesn't necessarily have to be a weird phenomenon. It can be caused by machinery. It can also be caused by weather as well. Weather, desert, changing frequently. Right. That and, you know, foreign military bases.
Yeah.
And nothing.
Yeah. I think one thing that really supports that view is the fact that the entire time this is happening, they feel a rumbling from within the earth. They feel this drilling machine drill and drill and drill. However, I will say that I didn't do any specific for the show, I'll completely admit, but I have researched infrasound before. It is more of a feeling thing than a visual, physical, see an apparition thing. While that does happen, but it goes a lot to say towards the level of detail that they go into whether or not infrasound could have been responsible.
And that's fair. A lot of times infrasound is associated with ghosts.
Right.
Because it is more like shadowy figures and things like that.
Right.
Escaping out of the corner of your eyes, things like that nature. Mm-hmm. So, no. Having, you know, these very descriptive beings that you're watching and looking at, not necessarily characteristics of infrasound, but the feeling of being watched.
Right.
In their own homes, even that.
Okay.
I do attest to it. That and, I mean, our minds are so easily tricked. And when we are looking for something, we tend to find it even though it's not there. So I think it could be a number of different things that are going on psychologically and, you know, deeper in their unconsciousness than what they are perceiving.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair.
Or drugs.
That's a good one, too. Love me some drugs.
Sam? Vicks Vapor Rub.
Vicks Vapor Rub.
Love that stuff.
Love it.
Helps me breathe at night.
Yeah, I feel like we went into a lot of the alternative explanations. Here's my thing. Just like with Whitley Strieber, they come around, oh, it was a wonderful,
right?
Joyous.
It's like
this
yeah.
was a good thing. No, dude, these beings psychologically, if this happened, the way they're describing
psychologically it, disturbing.
Tortured you.
I think.
Like, no, dude.
I think it kind of has to do with the whole idea that usually when we look back at past events,
right.
it's in a rose-colored lens. And I think that's similar to this, but at an extreme level.
And I agree. I want to state really quick, I came across some information regarding the Hess family, and especially, we didn't really mention it too much, but, you know, she got pregnant when they were being watched.
Right.
Their daughter...
Bethany?
Not Bethany. Bethany was the one already there.
Right.
I found the daughter's name. I'm not going to say it because they have not said it. And I don't feel like that's appropriate for me to be like, oh, this is her name. Look her up. So I'm not going to do that. But their daughter, they said, like, this is going to be a special child. This is going to be a child that can communicate with them. And there's actually a point when they see these dark swirling clouds outside after the child's birth. And they, like, automatically almost walk up, stand up, walk out.
Simba.
And they Simba that kid. Like, they hold her up and everything seems to stop and go down. So a lot of the people that I've been in contact with this, and I'm going to thank them at the end here, but the people that I've been talking to about this, one of their biggest question is, like, whatever happened to the girl?
Right. Yeah, that's an obvious question.
Now, again, I'm going off of half information here.
Because now she'd be, like, what, 25?
She'd be right around 27.
Oh, okay. Because
she was born in 1990. I don't have a line of communication with the Hess family or anything like that. I didn't feel like it was appropriate to reach out to them for, you know, just a podcast, especially since I only thought of doing that last night. But as far as I can tell, man, and this is what's, like, the really beautiful thing, all of these people, Don, Steve, their kids, they're all, like, happy, healthy, beautiful people with a rich and vibrant family life. No signs of, like, because you get, like, not that it's anything to be ashamed of or anything, but, like, you get, like, Whitley Strieber, totally normal guy who then becomes a prominent ufologist based on his experience, and it ends up, you know, bankrupting you and ruining you in a lot of ways in the public eye. I mean, this family is just living life, happy, healthy, normal. The young lady, I don't know.
Again, do you think that's because they just recently came out?
Well,
as being,
it's possible. Again, the story came originally in 1995 with searchers. They didn't come out until this last year. It is entirely possible that it's because they stayed a secret until 25 years later. Now, I mean, who cares? You're not going to ruin their lives now. I mean, but that's the thing, is they're not posting about aliens all the time. They're not talking about aliens at all. They're just having a good life. And so, you know, Hess family, if you hear this, like, good job surviving that, whatever it was. Personally, I'm going to say it. Aliens. Why not? Why not aliens? I mean, there are a few reasons, but it's one of those times where, again, nothing really fits completely. It fits certain things here and there. No explanation fully fits the phenomena other than aliens. And so that's what I'm going to go with. Anyway. Good on you guys for surviving. We're proud of you. You know, shoot me an email sometime if you ever want to tell me any. You're not going to hear this. I don't know who I'm talking to. All right, guys.
They don't listen to Supernatural podcasts.
No, they probably don't. We did it.
Oh, goodness.
We made it through the Mojave incident.
Two alien stories down.
We'll have at least two more by the end of the year. Still alive,
and I haven't freaked out on you quite so much yet.
And we want to shout out. We want to do a big
thanks. We're doing a shout out? Oh, man.
To our good friend, multi-universal treasure, Rob Christofferson, who he pointed us towards it.
Ah.
And then TJ.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah.
Jason's, I appreciate it.
Jason's really not happy with you. And then TJ, it just occurred to me right now, I've never said your last name out loud. I know you're listening to this, so I'm going to talk directly to you. TJ Cunahan. We're going with Cunahan, and I'm sure I'm wrong, and you can correct me later. We'd also like to give a big shout-out to TJ Cunahan, as well as Rob. They both kind of came together to suggest this episode to me, and I hope that you guys enjoyed it.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, Jason's not really happy with either one of you right now.
It was just a heavy, heavy episode.
It was dense.
Of... two eyewitness accounts, and
which we all know how Jason feels about eyewitness accounts.
You know, I mean, so I have two problems with both aliens and ghosts.
Right.
Or I guess one problem with both aliens and ghosts.
Right.
Is that we can't scientifically observe it.
Right.
Either of the phenomena, which is really annoying when you're trying to get to the bottom of things.
Totally fair.
So it bugs me.
I can dig it. All right. And now we're going to say some thanks.
Rob and TJ.
Rob and TJ. So thank you guys.
Why don't you guys give me a cryptid to debunk? Right? Come on.
Come on.
Throw me a bone.
Throw him a Bigfoot bone. Ayo. Snapperooza. Okay.
You don't want me to destroy Bigfoot, Sam.
You can't destroy him. He's immortal. All right. So we have some new reviews this week. So we would like to thank History Goes Bump, A. Dufresne, Ricola 70, Dave Bauer, Idaho Girl 4, and finally, we would actually also like to thank Great Goat XXLK.
Nice.
Now, Jason, I haven't told you about this.
Who's Great Goat?
He gave us our second ever 2-star review.
Yes!
And I'm not going to do this with every 2-star review. I'm sure as time goes on, we're going to get a lot more. But I do want to address it because he says something in here that resonates with me. He says, I used to enjoy this podcast and couldn't wait for the next one to air. One show, there were political comments made. I don't remember that, but that's fine.
Okay.
Kind of an epiphany moment when I realized they were young and not very professional. I'm older and forgot the generation gap and that this was geared towards younger listeners. Mostly good content, though. However, I listened for the entertainment value and the knowledge I gained for other ideas and points of views on the strange, paranormal, and other. They just ruined it for me. There are many other podcasts out there with mature hosts. So, first off, thank you for saying that we have mostly good content. I appreciate that. The other thing, though, that I really want to address here, we're not discriminating on age. I'm not sitting here like, how do I get the hip kids to listen to this? How do I get those cool 20-somethings on board? The super spooker natural.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Is that a word?
You heard me.
Just
the spooker natural. Actually, Rob coined that one.
Oh, darn.
Thanks, Rob. The spooker natural knows no bounds. Like, it does not, it's not like this is for old people, for young people, for anybody in between. We hope to be creating a multi-generational community. The young, the very young, the old, the extremely old. Anybody and everybody who wants into this podcast, I never want them feeling like, oh, this isn't for me. This podcast is for everyone, and we love you all wonderfully, and even you, Great Goat, because you contributed to our downloads some way or another. We love you. And, you know, it also comes down to there's a certain point where if they've stopped enjoying the show, so be it. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, give us another chance to come back.
No, this is the criticism that we need.
Yeah.
And we want.
It is. It is. At a certain point, if you don't enjoy the show, you don't enjoy the show, and that's fine, and we wish this fella, you know, many safe returns, happy travels, and I hope that he finds something that works better for him out there. So we wanted to address that. However, it is also that time of the month when we look at our international reviews.
Ooh, we get some.
Yes, we get some.
So those were all from iTunes then, Sam? Or
yes, those are all iTunes reviews, which is a great, wonderful way to support the podcast if you're interested in doing that. For one thing, it just makes me happy to see. For another thing, I'm told that it ups our ranking and like the iTunes store and stuff like that. But in any case, it just makes us happy to see. So I'm going to read out these names here. We would like to thank some of our international listeners. We would like to thank so far Core989 from Canada. We would like to thank Matthew A. Seymour from Australia. We would like to thank Angelo Fiorentino from Canada. We'd like to thank R.M. Teasdale from Australia. That's it.
Sweet. Cool. I love both Canada and Australia.
They're
and our listeners from
our
them.
Our favorite countries.
They're great.
They're fantastic.
We got to make a trip up north one of these days.
One of these days. Scott, if you're listening to this, you know who you are. I'm talking to Scott Thrower of the Fairy Tales for Unwanted Children podcast. I'm going to come to your house. We're going to hang out. It's going to be great. Cool. Now that's weird.
Does he live next to bald eagles? I want to go see some real bald eagles.
I've seen bald eagles in Portland.
I mean, yeah, but A lot of them.
Just droves of them. All right. And then one last thing we're going to read. We read a sad review. Or not a sad review. We read a not so positive review. And then...
I mean, to be completely honest, most of the things I say, I don't mean in a serious manner.
That's true.
I mean, that kind of goes for my entire life.
He is a jokester, if you will.
But just throwing that out there, too.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're going to read one of these international reviews, and this is actually from Matthew A. Seymour in Australia. Hello, Matthew. How you doing, buddy?
Why do you say hello?
Hello!
Why?
Jerry, like... hello!
Oh.
Yeah.
All right.
It's Uncle Leo.
Hey, Matt. From Australia.
Matt from Australia. Hello.
What you got?
So he says, guys, I listen to a lot of paranormal conspiracy podcasts, and this is top-notch stuff. Really clean and professional, in my opinion. Helps me and my mate get through the work day, or get through work every day, and we love to discuss these kind of topics whilst there. Thanks for doing what you do, fellas. Keep up the great work. Big props from Australia. You guys have got some fans down under. I'm spreading the word. And then he gives... the rock on symbol emoji.
The horns.
The evil eye. Anyway, cool. Thanks, Matt. That's great. That didn't sound super like authentic. Thank you, Matthew. That's fantastic. Yeah. One of my favorite continents. Yeah, one of my favorite things is like to sit.
Everything's deadly.
And Jason just wants to die.
Wow.
And then we have one new patron this week as well.
Oh gosh.
We would like to thank Isaac Rodenheiser for becoming our newest patron.
All right, Isaac!
You know who you are. Anyway, that sounds really cryptic, but I'm not going to elaborate. All right. One of those reviews we mentioned is from History Goes Bump, which is a fantabulous podcast, as my mother would say, fantabulous. And it is just a great discussion on... a variety, like literally over 100 haunted places at this point, with firsthand accounts, amazing interviews, all sorts of great resources there. So, and it's just entertaining. It's just fun. Diane and the co-hosts just do an amazing job, and we're so grateful that they make their show. And I highly recommend every single one of you, if you haven't already, listen to History Goes Bump. We'll put a link to it on our blog post. So that's the other thing. We no longer are going to be including the links in the show notes based on some different things that have gone on. But in every show note, we will have a link to the blog post that has all of the links, pictures, everything you need to fully enjoy this episode. So,
Sam, what'd you get in trouble for?
Well, I didn't get in trouble with anything. It's just that Audio Boom doesn't support full HTML linking or hyperlinking.
Oh, okay.
So it's just a lot easier. Instead of me copy-pasting like 1,000 HTMLs and just clogging it up, just make a face or a blog post about
That's
it.
That's fair. Okay.
On our website at notalonepodcast.com, everybody order t-shirts. We're like 5 days away from the end of pre-orders. We got 3 so far. So take that, everyone. We did it. we sold 3 t-shirts. And I think we are true.
It's all right. Coming out with some dope graphics.
Done. Yeah, we are.
It's going to be great.
Okay. Jason?
Let you chew on that.
I don't think we need it. You know, let me just do this because I haven't done it for like the last 3 shows. For one thing, if you want to support the show, please think about leaving a review in iTunes. If you feel like what we're doing here, the time we spent on this, is worth a little bit of you know, money back, you can go to our Patreon at patreon.com/notalonepodcast.
If you'd like to support the podcast.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. You can donate in a $1, $3, or $5 amount, depending on what you feel is fair. But even if you don't want to do that, we still love you. We still think you're great. Check out our social media. We're on Twitter at Not Alone Pod. We're on Instagram at Not Alone Podcast. And we're on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast. Although technically it's Not Alone Pod. Facebook.com/Not Alone Pod. But if you search for Not Alone Podcast, we come up there.
And Sam is all about the Twitters. He will respond very quickly.
I am on Twitter all day, every day. I hated it at first, and now I love it.
Really?
I adore it. Yeah.
I still can't get into it.
It's because Wendy's isn't active. I know.
I know. I only made a Twitter account to follow Wendy's.
To see them throw and some
Bill
sick
Nye,
burns.
But you know.
You know those Wendy's tweet photos are shopped, right?
I believed the internet, Sam.
That was your first mistake.
That was my problem.
All right. Who did it last week? What was last
Dude,
week?
Rock last Apes, that was week you. Was big. Yeah. Kay. Yep.
Remember, whether in the desert heat of the Mojave at 9:13 p.m. or sleeping in bed as a figure emerges from the wall to wrap its long spindly fingers around your face, you are not alone.